the riddle of third quarter GDP. Consumers consuming, but business ain't booming. From APM, it's the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich. It is the 26th of October. Happy Friday, everybody. Along with GDP, we've got a bunch of tech companies in the spotlight today. We'll talk about that. We'll get reaction from China to a New York Times expose on the country's leaders' finances. And we'll talk about a new Beatles invasion. This time, the main casualty is not wilting teenage girls. It is Canadian lumber and the cost of building U.S. homes.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
The initial estimate of third quarter U.S. domestic product, GDP, did not disappoint when we got it this morning. The 2% growth is a nice increase from the 1.3% we had in the previous quarter. Of course, these numbers often get revised down the road, but that's what we have to work with for now. To talk it through a little bit, I got Chris Lowe. He's chief economist at FTN Financial, often with us on Fridays. Chris, good to talk with you.
Good morning.
All right, the GDP figure, 2%. How strong is that?
Well, look, you know, it's tepid, I think, is the right way to put it. We'd love to see 3% or better. We haven't seen it in a while. But on the other hand, it's more impressive than the growth rates we're seeing around the rest of the world. And it's faster than second quarter's GDP, which was only up 1.3%. So, you know, on balance, it's pretty good.
If we are moving forward, what's driving that growth?
Well, there were a lot of moving pieces this quarter. One of the encouraging signs, consumer spending was stronger. It was up 2%. We didn't make 2% last quarter. The pickup there, the fastest growth was in durable goods spending. A lot of people buying iPhones, but also some decent car sales, which boosted the numbers. On the other side, business spending was down, and that's probably because businesses are worried about these big tax increases looming at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And government spending was very strong.
I want to ask you a little more about that. Within these numbers, we're seeing something that in the separate data releases we've seen in the last couple of weeks. Consumers, home buyers generally feeling okay. Businesses, on the other hand, very cautious on purchases, on hiring. How do you explain that kind of a difference in sentiment?
Well, I think part of it is what's at stake. Everybody knows that Congress is going to come back, and most likely they're going to push this, what we call a fiscal cliff, these looming tax increases out over a longer period of time so they don't have a huge economic impact. But there is that very small possibility that they don't. And because the consequences for businesses making a big investment in new equipment or in employment would be so extreme, it makes sense to wait. But because of that, when Congress does resolve the tax hikes, I think there's probably quite a bit of pent-up business spending that will boost GDP growth next year.
Sure. Chris Lowe at FTN Financial. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
So GDP, there's the day's big number. Let's check on the rest. Not terribly upbeat on Wall Street, at least not at this hour. The Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ all down. The NASDAQ down the most of all, about 0.2%. So it looks like we're headed for a down day so far. That said, a new consumer sentiment index released today does put our mood as consumers this month at the best in 5 years. People are more upbeat about their own prospects and the prospects of the economy. We had a strong earnings report this morning from Comcast, helped along by, of all things, NBC for a change. The afterglow from the London Olympics continued to pay off into the latest quarter, and Comcast also saw a healthy rise in cable internet subscribers. Comcast stock in the first couple hours of trading is up more than 2%. Well, many of the stocks to watch today are in tech. Apple, Amazon, and Microsoft are all in the spotlight for various reasons. We're going to pull them together now in a bit of a roundup with Larry Dignan. He is the editor-in-chief at the tech news site ZDNet. Larry, welcome to Marketplace.
Good to be here.
So let's start with Apple. The high point for them might have been Tuesday this week, showing off the new iPad mini. The low point, maybe today, when investors are reacting to some kind of blah third quarter earnings. What happened?
On Tuesday, Apple unveiled its iPad mini, and I think the biggest shocker was probably the price tag. As it is, the price tag now is north of, you know, what a larger Kindle Fire would be. and it's also north of, you know, the $199 Google tablets.
I think some people are reacting today to Apple's earnings report because it didn't have the kind of wonderful surprise people come to expect from Apple.
Yeah, well, I think in the new Tim Cook era,
the new CEO, yeah.
You know, the announcement almost seems anticlimactic at some point because a lot of the news has been out already.
Let's talk about Amazon.com, a loss at Amazon, first time in 5 years. What's the prognosis there?
The big theme with Amazon, and it's been one going on multiple quarters, is just investment. These guys are pouring money into the business. Amazon's always investing in fulfillment. They're investing in tablets. There's just a lot of investment going on, and that kills earnings.
And Larry, Microsoft's big day is finally here, Windows 8 and the Surface tablet. What do you think? Will people buy these things, and will they enjoy them?
I think it's going to be a slow uptake, to be honest. I think there are multiple wild cards, and I think anyone that tells you they know how Windows 8 is going to do is just lying, right? Because there's a new user interface. There are all sorts of different kinds of hardware to go with it. There are convertibles, which are tablets and laptops that are kind of smushed together. They're just tablets. They're just laptops. They're laptops with touch screens. And so I think for the consumer, you not only have to learn a new interface, you're going to have almost too much choice in hardware. And I've probably played with a dozen devices with Windows 8 on it, which mm-hmm. You know, I got used to Windows 8 pretty quickly. But some of these devices are just clunkers.
Microsoft's kind of shooting the moon here, is what I hear you saying. It's a gamble.
Oh, it's a total. They've bet the company that they can, you know, become a phone, tablet, and PC player with one operating system. So I give them a lot of credit for making the big bet. But how this bet turns out is anyone's guess.
Okay. Larry Dignan is editor-in-chief at ZDNet. Thanks a lot, Larry.
Thanks a lot.
And let's just take a quick check of those tech stocks we talked about to see what's going on. Apple, not surprisingly, is down almost 3%, so an unusual day for a stock that's used to heading in the other direction. Amazon, though, is up almost 3%. Investors apparently think all those investments and acquisitions Amazon has been doing that have been costing it profits are going to pay off in the long term. And Microsoft, of course, on their big day, is up about 0.3%. So with today's release of that new Windows tablet, the Surface we just talked about, Microsoft is keen to show that thing off. I thought this was kind of funny. The head of the company's Windows division yesterday set out to demonstrate the strength of the thing. Steve Sanofsky strapped 4 skateboard wheels onto a Surface tablet. Then he popped on a truly styling helmet. And in New York, he went cruising down the sidewalk on his little Surface skateboard for a while. Not entirely clear how much damage was done, although I have to think if the thing had been destroyed, they would not have publicized this stunt, so it must have been okay. Guess it's nice to know that after you use the Surface to map your way home, in a real pinch, you maybe can actually ride it there.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
The man credited with transforming pro basketball in the U.S. into a $5 billion a year business is stepping down. NBA Commissioner David Stern says he's going to retire in February 2014. That would mark 30 years since he took over. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now on the legacy of a man who transformed the business of basketball.
At a press conference yesterday, David Stern said something most in the NBA can agree with.
The league is in, I think, terrific condition.
Even the players' union boss, who tangled with them on tough contract talks over the years, said Stern, quote, will always be synonymous with the phenomenal growth. But Stern can't take all the credit for growing the league. Kenneth Shropshire directs the Sports Business Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania.
His ability to do that was largely dependent on the high quality of players that happened to emerge when he arrived. Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson.
Stern skillfully used that star power to turn the NBA from a second-tier league into a global force, adding 7 new teams along the way. It's hard to imagine now, but in the early 80s, the NBA finals weren't even broadcast live. Now networks bid fortunes for rights. Players, team owners, athletic brands, they love Stern because he made them all filthy rich. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On November 6th, voters in Chicago won't just be voting folks into or out of office. They're also going to decide whether or not to grant City Hall the authority to act as an energy broker. The goal would be to secure cheaper energy rates for Chicago residents. It's something called municipal electricity aggregation. From WBEZ in Chicago, Lauren Chulgen explains what that is.
It takes a lot of energy to power Stephen Schwartz's four-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bathroom colonial in Chicago's northern suburbs.
It has all the problems that an older house has in terms of, you know, the older windows that aren't terribly well insulated, you know, the uninsulated brick exterior, that kind of thing.
He's always looking for ways to save money, shutting lights off, conserving heat or air conditioning. But nothing's done more for his wallet than the Village of Wilmette's new municipal electricity aggregation program. It cut his electricity rate in half.
What's not to like about that?
Wilmette is one of 248 municipalities in Illinois with the program, and Chicago could soon join them. Under the plan, the city would act like a big box store, using the pricing power of the city's residential and small business utility customers to negotiate cheaper rates. David Collada is executive director of the Citizens Utility Board, an energy watchdog group. He says right now the main power supplier in Chicago, Commonwealth Edison, charges
8.32 cents a kilowatt hour.
Meanwhile, smaller suppliers could offer the city an average rate of
4.83 cents.
ComEd has not come out against the plan. It gets paid to maintain Chicago's power grid, whether it supplies energy or not. But Collada warns the cheap rates of a municipal aggregation program might not last forever.
Just because you're saving now, this isn't a magic bullet, and it may not always work.
He says ComEd's higher prices are set to expire next June, and they're expected to decline after that, maybe even lower than what smaller suppliers could offer. But while Chicago voters mull their options, small energy suppliers are anxiously waiting to see who City Hall might choose to replace ComEd. Dave Fine is VP of State Government Affairs for Constellation Energy.
There could be 900,000 eligible customers for this program. It would be the largest single solicitation of its kind. Anywhere in the country.
But just like the presidential election, all parties will just have to wait and see what happens on November 6th. In Chicago, I'm Lauren Chulgen for Marketplace.
Let's go international here for a few minutes. It's a little tricky to get to the New York Times this morning if you're in China. The country's blocking the website because of an expose on the family of Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao. The story in the New York Times draws on corporate and regulatory records to show how Wen's family has reportedly hidden riches worth $2.7 billion. Earlier today, my colleague Jeremy Hobson checked in with our Marketplace China Bureau Chief, Rob Schmitz. Here's Jeremy.
So, Rob, you've seen the story. What else does it say?
Well, it appears from the reporting of the Shanghai correspondent of the New York Times, David Barboza, that the relatives of Premier Wen Jiabao, including his son, his wife, and his own mother, have become incredibly wealthy during his stint as premier of China. They've accrued hundreds of millions of dollars during that time. And not only that, but they try to hide this wealth through the use of holding companies and various other investment vehicles.
And this guy, Wen Jiabao, is known for his humble roots, as we said. So is this going to come as a surprise to people that he's got so much money?
Well, it depends on how many people see it, but really this couldn't have happened to a more popular leader among mainstream Chinese. Wen Jiabao is commonly referred to as Grandpa Wen because he's always showing up after a natural disaster or a crisis, and he mingles with the people, he shows compassion. He's also taken a public stand against corruption within the party, and that's why a story about his family profiting from his position is really a bombshell for China's government at the worst possible time. As you know, China's 18th Party Congress begins in 2 weeks, and that's the event where the party will pick its new leaders. So really, this couldn't have come at a worse time.
Well, and is it going to have an impact, do you think? I mean, are people going to see this story, especially since the Times website has been blocked now?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, many Chinese already have a cynical view of their leaders, and they assume all of their leaders are all corrupt. But they've rarely been able to point at real evidence. And, you know, this story showed evidence of corruption at the highest levels of the government. So that's, of course, the reason it's being blocked. But some Chinese in urban areas especially have VPNs, virtual private networks, that enable them to get over the Great Firewall of China. So they'll be able to see it. But I think for the most part, many Chinese will be left in the dark.
Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And now to a new set of beetles taking North America by storm. This time the casualty is lumber and lumber prices. The mountain pine beetle is taking a dramatic toll, apparently, on Canadian forests, which are critical for home building and other lumber needs here in the U.S. A lumber industry consultant called the International Wood Markets Group has sounded the alarm in a recent report. Russell Taylor is the president of the group, and he's with me from Vancouver, British Columbia. Good to talk with you.
Yes, good morning, Jeff.
So what exactly do the mountain pine beetles do to the trees that they get into?
Well, these very tiny beetles, about the size of a grain of rice, they basically flock to a tree and they bury into it and lay their eggs, and that basically kills the flow of water up and down the tree, and they basically kill everything in sight as they grow and grow and grow. So it's been one of the largest natural disasters we can think of all time.
How widespread are they now, and how bad do you think it could get?
They're unstoppable, and they've now pretty much ravaged the forests of British Columbia, where we think about already almost half of all the pine trees in the province have been killed. And they've moved all the way across the Rocky Mountains into the neighboring province of Alberta. And there's pine trees all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. So this thing has legs, shall we say. We don't see it slowing down in the interim.
How big a factor can you say that these beetles are in driving up the prices of home construction, say, here in the U.S.?
Well, we've been actually predicting what we call a super cycle in lumber starting somewhere around now. In fact, we thought 2012, 2013 is when we start to see it occurring, and we're seeing it occurring, and we think the peak years of 2014 and 15 are going to see prices literally going through the roof as the supply-side dynamics get tighter and as the U.S. demand and the U.S. housing market comes roaring back.
And you can blame a lot of that on the beetle, huh?
For the first time in many housing recoveries, the B.C. industry will participate to a certain point, and then our production starts to drop. In Canada, our market share is going to drop to probably below 20% by the end of the decade. So, sorry guys, we can't help you out this cycle. You're on your own. Then that's going to drive prices higher, and we expect European wood to pour into the U.S. market, but they're going to be responsible for filling in the gap.
Interesting stuff. Glad to learn about it. Russell Taylor with the International Wood Markets Group in Vancouver. Thanks.
Hey, my pleasure.
Little political news as we wind toward a close here. Decide for yourself if this coincidence is just too good to be true. Yesterday, Ann Romney appeared on The Rachel Ray Show, do a little cooking. Ann and Rachel whipped up Mitt Romney's favorite dish, meatloaf cakes. Okay, so then last night, same day, at a giant rally in Ohio, Mitt Romney welcomed to the stage and celebrated the enthusiastic celebrity endorsement of none other than the singer Meatloaf. And finally, Mitt Romney, we know, probably won't partake of this, but on this Friday, how about a little beer to help the meatloaf go down? A Scottish brewery has just launched what it is billing as the world's most potent beer, Brewmeister Armageddon is the name of it, and it has an alcohol content of 65% by volume, which is a little bit insane. Compare that to a can of Budweiser, which is 5%, or even a tumbler of Johnny Walker whiskey, which is 40%. The brewer describes the experience of Armageddon as a, quote, supersonic charged explosion, but then does go on its website to recommend that this beer's for sipping, not for chugging. That's all for today. Everybody have a great weekend. I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.